Tech Weekly is sponsored by crunch.co.uk, expert online accountants for freelancers, contractors, and small businesses.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and on this week's programme, we ask why the Motion Picture Association of America is picking on British Telecom, how Scotland Yard intends to combat computer hacking, and how Google's Chrome web browser has outfoxed the competition. Also, we'll be finding out how to interpret the content on websites that end in .xxx. Joining me to tackle this week's technology news stream are digital media correspondent Jemima Kish and technology editor Charles Arthur. Welcome to you both.
Buongiorno.
Oh.
Hello.
We've got a multilingual and a reticent. I'm not quite sure about that, Jemima.
I'm tired. There was a landslide.
Oh, there was
I
a landslide.
I had to stay in London.
Well, this week, an FOI Freedom of Information request found that civil servants in the Department of Transport look for their news on the BBC, use Google to search the web, and have an unexpected fascination with fantasy role-playing games. The request resulted in a list of the top sites visited by employees of the government office and included over 27,000 hits on a belly dancing studio site, almost 100,000 hits on a site for fans of the Roman Empire, and a veritable torrent of visits to a site where people can vent their frustrations about bad manners. Charles, do me a favor and stick on your pop psychology hat. What does this say about the people who work for the Department of Transport?
I think it means that I think they're quite well adjusted, actually. I mean, you know, using Google and the BBC, that's pretty straightforward. Obviously, you know, they could use The Guardian, but
of course they could.
I think the belly dancing studio is good. That's, you know, that's looking for exercise.
How on earth 27,000 hits? It's not just one person clicking 27,000
around the office. Perhaps they would have got a discount if they get 27,000 people to sign up.
So it's a giant Groupon special.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think the frustration about bad manners, I suspect that if you work as a civil servant in the Department of Transport, possibly you deal with people whose manners aren't the best.
I think that's very insightful, actually, given my history of speaking with people who do timetables. Apologies, blanket apology. Jemima, what do you think they would find if they looked at The Guardian's and The Observer's webcam?
Well, you mean beyond Twitter and Facebook? Oh, God, I don't know. Probably Ottolenghi vegetarian lunch recipes and Mumsnet and yoga videos on YouTube.
And how to cook your
mum's. Or is that just me? I don't know.
Puzzle.
It might just be me.
I think you're projecting to the rest of the King's Place building. Also joining us this week is Paul Walsh from MetaCert. Paul, welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
If I was to look at your personal web cache, what would I find? Belly dancing, perhaps?
Could we have the diplomatic answer that your wife can hear?
It would certainly be a different stash to the one that I had during the mid-90s when I was at AOL and had to go out and search the web for all kinds of things. Now it would be just lots of cookies from The Guardian, of course, including the podcast.
Including Ottolenghi.
No, 10 house points.
Yes, ding, ding. Well, me, I'm staying silent, so don't ask. Join us for the next 30 minutes of news and analysis on Tech Weekly from The Guardian. First in this week's technology news, a UK judge has ruled that BT must block British users' access to the Seychelles-based website Newsbin 2 because Newsbin 2 infringes copyright holdings of members of the Motion Picture Association of America. The site links users to locations online where they can access and download copyrighted materials. Now, this is the first time that a judge has ruled that an ISP, BT, must block a site. Joining us down the line is Chris Marsich, the president and MD of the MPAA European office. Chris, tell me, why did the MPAA go for Newsbin 2? Aren't there other sites that need blocking just as much?
There may be, but Newsbin was a particularly egregious example of a site that was stealing content and making money on it. And it had already been condemned by a UK court and simply left the UK and moved to the Seychelles to continue to do what it was doing before. So it was basically flaunting the UK laws. Because it was an important pirate site and because there had already been a conviction against them, we decided that it was necessary to take the next step and to invite BT to help promote legality, basically, on the Internet.
So why just BT? Now, obviously, this is a single incident. You're focusing on this particular case and this particular site. But why not other ISPs who provide access to Newsbin too?
I think that's a matter of law for the most part. It is expected that the other ISPs will also abide by the order and act responsibly and, promote legality, basically, by denying access to Newsbin, the condemned site.
Obviously, though, this depends upon how BT, who was named in the case, responds to this. And as far as I'm aware, Charles, what's been BT's response? They haven't been, they haven't sort of jumped on the results of this, have they?
Well, BT has said, BT has to go by what the court orders, really. But actually, they've said the judgment is actually helpful. We welcome it because it clarifies a complex area of law and shows that rights holders can use the copyright laws in this country. It means they have to prove a site is infringing before a court and get a court order. Chris, I'd just like to ask a question. I mean, why not go to the Seychelles government? Why not prosecute this in the Seychelles? Why not go after the site rather than the ISP?
Well, the site obviously has a history of moving around opportunistically, and they are catering to the public in the UK, and that's where their primary business really takes place.
Is it so most of the traffic comes, more than 50% of the traffic comes from the UK?
Yes.
Can I ask how you establish that?
I would have to talk to our experts or have them talk to you about it, but it is a site whose primary audiences in the UK.
Isn't there an issue for saying that, firstly, by bringing this case, which I clearly, the MPAA clearly feels it has to do so that it is seen to be protecting the copyright of its members, but isn't there an argument that just by bringing this case, you are helping people find out about piracy sites, and also that you're encouraging people to go to lesser-known ISPs because they're less likely to be targeted?
I don't think that the awareness level issue is real. I think that there is awareness of pirate sites and of their existence, and so simply by taking legal action, I think we've put the spotlight on the fact that many of these sites are engaging in illegal activities, and the consumer ought to know about that. So in that sense, I think it will be a contribution, really, to consumer awareness and knowledge, and hopefully will cause them to go to legal sites to obtain their content. As for whether these sites would move to other ISPs or not, that remains to be seen. I hope and believe that all ISPs will take their responsibilities in the face of a very clear and incisive decision from Mr. Justice Arnold.
So would you go after, for example, the Pirate Bay next? Do you have a sort of a list of sites you want to hit?
No, there isn't a list right now of sites. I mean, there are a relatively limited number of sites that systematically pirate and that really don't do anything but pirate. So they're not purveyors of any other sort of information. But it's a relatively limited number, I think, and ultimately manageable. But it was important to get the precedent set so that it's clear what the law says and what the responsibilities are of the intermediaries.
Do you think that generally you're winning this war or losing it?
Well, I think that with this judgment, we've taken a big step in the right direction. I think that sites that make money illegally in the manner of Newsbin will now understand that it is not simply a free ride for them, and that they cannot expect to be able to continue to do business in the manner in which they have so far.
Paul, the judge's ruling was that BT had knowledge of people using its service to infringe copyright. So focusing on the ISP, as we've established here. But doesn't this case that Chris is talking about, doesn't this push ISPs nearer to a potentially dangerous point where they become the judge and jury of content?
Absolutely. Where do you stop? It's censorship. It's the government getting the ISPs to censor on their behalf. I think the music industry needs to be more innovative and come up with a better business model, or the movie industry. Both movie and music is kind of in the same boat, if you will, when it comes to piracy, and it's always going to be with us. I think they need to come up with new ways to sell their content. And I think by taking one organization or one company to court is actually not going to help much at all, apart from demonstrate them flexing their muscles.
But at the same
but
time...
But there are innovative new services out there in both the music and film areas. It's just very difficult to compete with free. And I think that nothing could be farther from the truth on the censorship argument. I don't see how one can make the argument that it's censorship to apply the law to those who break it on the internet. I just don't see it. Those sites do nothing but, especially Newsbin, it did nothing but make available content that they had no authorization to make available. They were stealing.
I don't disagree with that, Chris, but I think it's absolutely wrong to expect the ISPs to enforce the law.
The ISPs, under existing laws, which emanate from European directives and have their counterparts elsewhere in the world, have some responsibility. It's not a liability, but they do have some responsibility for what goes on the internet. They are not mere conduits in the sense of being able to simply turn a blind eye to illegality. And court sanction. I mean, you know, we're talking about a court action here.
One thing I can sort of throw into the mix, which I happen to have learned in the past hour or so, is that Vince Cable is going to, in a speech on Wednesday, say that he doesn't think that web blocking works, that he thinks that what he sort of terms censorship isn't effective, but that the sanctions that exist under copyright law are strong enough already, and he thinks that's what should be used.
This follows the Hargreaves review into intellectual copyright that came out in May. But tomorrow night, Vince Cable is going to talk about that exact point. Wednesday night, sorry. Yeah, and he's also expected to say that the UK is going to move to legitimise the ripping of digital copies of music and films if it's for personal use. That's something that has been legal in the States and hasn't been legal in the UK, and that's quite an important development.
Jemima, how does this sit within the infrastructure or the scaffolding that was established when the Digital Economy Act was pushed through?
Well, they've still been trying to work out how the DEA will practice. So although that has passed as law, they're still trying to work out how exactly that will exist, how it will be enforced. We'll still have to watch that space, I think.
Thank you very much, Chris Marsich. Also this week, Google's Chrome has pipped Firefox as the second most popular browser in the UK. According to statistics released last week by Interstat, the search engine's homegrown internet portal has attracted 22% of the UK market share. Although this still lags behind Microsoft Internet Explorer's 45% market share, it does overtake the alternative from the Mozilla Corporation. Charles, why has this happened?
Partly it's because Chrome has had loads and loads of advertising, which always gets people's attention. So it's been advertised on the front of Google, where lots of people go every day. It's been advertised in posters on the tube. It's been advertised in newspapers. It's been advertised on television. Eventually, that sort of thing does tend to make a difference.
There was the big push where they said anybody can use any of these four different browsers when you first log in. We talked about that last year.
Which but, made a minimal impact.
But why suddenly have people thought, oh God, well, I don't like what Internet Explorer does, because it ultimately it's taken share away from Internet Explorer.
Well, I'm not sure if that's necessarily the case. I mean, there's it's very hard to work out who's got share from who. The trend in which Internet Explorer is losing market share is ongoing, but it seems to be people are upgrading. Yeah, that people move to Chrome because they hear about it from other people. Other people say, hey, I really like it. It's really quick. And I think certainly the thing that Chrome has... Well, there's two things that Chrome has which other browsers don't have. First of all, it is very fast. Yeah, and you can I super stress test mine, so I have about 100 tabs open on each of four windows at a time.
And ditto that.
Yeah,
we just hammer them.
Yeah, exactly, and it keeps going. But for most people, they're not doing that. So, Chrome is going to be really super speedy. And the other thing is that it's got Google Search built right into the toolbar. So if you just want to ask a question, and a lot of people do this already, a lot of people go to Google to look up where is a site. So they're looking for The Guardian, and they'll go to Google and enter The Guardian. So for a lot of people, their habit is to start typing into the URL bar.
This is part of Google's obsession with cutting down search times by milliseconds, which sort of instant results and instant pages did, and so cutting out only having one bar that does search and addresses is all part of that strategy. But the other thing
that's very good about it for Google is that it means that there's no chance someone is going to switch their preference from going to Google to Bing to Yahoo to whatever. It means, you know, if you're using Chrome, you're pretty much tied into Google, and that's great for them. That cuts down their what's called their traffic acquisition cost, their TAC, which again means that they make more money per search.
Jemima, I noticed the other day when I popped down to your desk that you use Chrome. Other search engines are available, but of course at the moment we're talking about Chrome. I'm still on Firefox. Why should I switch?
I find it faster, although people have said that with later versions of Mac OS, it's a bit more clunky. And I think with the really new version of Mac OS, it's quite buggy and crashes a lot. But I found it really good, really fast, really stable when handling loads of tabs, as Charles said. I still use it in conjunction with Firefox for various reasons to do with our internal content management system. So I have sort of multiple browsers open, really, and also to handle multiple Gmail accounts. I think what's really interesting and what hasn't been mentioned in this story is the role of mobile and mobile browsers, which, if it is included in these statistics, would have a big bearing on it, because I have used Internet Explorer on a Windows mobile phone, and it was awful. And obviously, that's a very small share of mobile browsers. So you'd expect to see a surge in Chrome on Android and Safari on iPhones, which is an important point. But I do remember it wasn't that long ago that Google said they would never do any traditional advertising. So to see them doing leaflets in magazines, of all things, and then huge big outdoor posters, well, indoor really, on the tube, is a bit of a turnaround. But, you know, perhaps that's working.
How long, Charles, do you expect that this is going to remain the pecking order?
That's a really wonderful question, to which I don't think there's any simple answer. I
mean,
Internet Explorer is probably going to dominate, and when you get the next rush of Windows, sort of autumn next year, Windows 8, that'll be pushing Internet Explorer 9. I don't know. You know, Chrome actually can still keep going upwards.
Paul?
I'm sensing that the vast majority of Chrome users are actually early adopters, a bit like Firefox. Our parents, our older siblings don't use these browsers at all. And Firefox has, or at least did, the last time I looked at the stats, about 30-35% global market share. But it kind of stagnated around there. And maybe it was because they couldn't cross the chasm into mainstream, whereas Internet Explorer is known by everybody.
And of course, Chrome, with, as you were saying, Charles, the fact that it lands, when you land on the Google homepage, it's right there and it's being advertised. Whatever happened to Opera?
Opera's Ooh. Still there, but it's the teeny tiny sort of number. Opera's big on mobile because it's used on a lot of Nokia phones abroad. But the question of where Opera goes is one of the more interesting ones in the browser world.
If you think about the mainstream, though, this is very interesting for browsers because for a lot of people, and I always think of my mum in these scenarios, but changing browsers is actually something they don't really think is that necessary. So you can look at these figures and think that's actually quite amazing that Chrome has nearly half the market share of Internet Explorer.
More on the browser wars at guardian.co.uk/technology. Finally in the news this week, Charles has continued to hack away, if you excuse the pun, at the Lulzsec story, picking apart even more detail in the unfolding events that have surrounded this hacker network. Charles, what is the latest?
Jake Davis, aged 18, who is alleged by the police to have used the online name Topiary, was bailed on Monday at the City of Westminster Magistrates Court. He lived in the Shetland Islands in a small settlement called Midyell, which is just slightly northerly part of the Shetland Islands. He didn't say anything at the hearing apart from to confirm his name and birth date. And he's now being given bail, as I say, to reappear at the end of August. The bail conditions include that he has to wear a tag, has to be inside between 10 p.m. and 7 a.m., He's not allowed to use the internet either directly or indirectly, which means he can't ask someone to go and do something on the internet for him. I'm not sure whether this means, I suspect it can't mean that he can't be told things off the internet, because that would be a bit bizarre.
That ruins his pub quiz possibilities.
Well,
doesn't it?
Yeah. And he can't use a mobile phone or telephone which has internet access. I mean, it's interesting. Yeah, he's born in 1992. So, you know, by my thinking, basically, he's living in 1992 again.
Yeah, a big clunky brick phone with no kind of
no internet at home. You know, be reading newspapers and listening to the radio.
They could have punished him more by making him use the internet only through dial-up.
And what do you know about Scotland Yard's newly announced computer hacking task force, Operation Tuleta?
Well, this is interesting because it goes back, it sort of circles around back again to News International and phone hacking, except this is now alleging computer hacking. So Ian Hurst, who was a former Army intelligence officer, said that the Metropolitan Police was formally investigating his claim that his computer was hacked by a private investigator working for the News of the World. The allegation is that he was sent a virus which basically gave anyone full access to his computer, Varad. Now, I've heard from two other people who allege that they too had their computers hacked in this way and they suspect News International involvement. I haven't been able to follow it up in any detail with them, but it'll be interesting to see quite what comes out of this, because the whole idea of phone hacking is one thing where you're using a PIN to access someone's voicemail. You could argue that it's something which is not difficult to do, but the idea of actually basically crossing the line and going over into the Computer Misuse Act, which has very hefty penalties, that's quite different.
So this therefore has nothing to do with seeking out hacker groups like LulzSec or anonymous.
Not at the moment. It doesn't seem to be. It's very much focused on the narrow question of did anyone acting for News International infect computers with a virus in order to get the contents.
Read up on all these stories and more at guardian.co.uk/technology. Later this year, ICM Registry will begin selling new domain names that end with the web address .xxx. Most of us can imagine what kind of content will be published on sites with this registration. But Paul Walsh, you've been with us the entire program, and your company believes that it's still important to classify it. MetaCert has entered a contract with ICM Registry to certify each XXX site. Why?
So that people can find out more information about the content and its suitability, and then make up their own mind as to whether or not they should visit that website. So we classify each XXX website, as well as other adult sites that reside on other TLDs like .com and .org. And we contain that list in our database, and we have a browser add-on that you can install for Firefox to begin with our goal being integrated with the mainstream browsers. And what happens is, in Google search results, you get a little tiny icon beside each search result, which tells you more information about the content and its suitability. So if you're in work, for example, you'll know whether or not it's safe to open up that link, or if you're sitting with a five-year-old, or if you just simply want to exclude that information and block it for your children. So it's not about censoring the web, and it's not about doing anything on behalf of people. We don't decide what's appropriate. What we do is we provide more information about the content and its suitability. And XXX, in its contract with ICANN, is obliged to label every website so that this can be made possible.
What proportion do you imagine of .xxx will be unsuitable content, and what proportion do you think will be perfectly nascent content?
I would imagine the vast majority of it will be unsuitable for children, because the whole point of having a .xxx domain is actually to host adult content. And by adult content, I mean specifically sexually explicit content. Companies like Disney, for example, are likely to buy the domain, but it'll be redirected on the DNS, so it'll be protected. And so they won't host, obviously, child-friendly content. So a great portion of the websites.
My mind is boggling it. What will the icons be? Who's going to go through?
Yeah, who's
and
going
do
to
it?
Then going to sort of squeegee out your brains and everything that's gone behind your eyes after you've gone through all of the content?
Well, we don't have to go through the content. We've actually built some cool technology. We've got a spidering technology which crawls adult websites, and it labels it automatically based on the content on those websites. And it also then pulls in all of the outbound links. So if an adult site links to another adult site, it gets pulled into our system, and it's automatically labeled based on the information contained in the title, description, the metadata, and so on.
How can this spidering technology identify the explicitness of a photograph, for example? You know, what are you looking for? Tag words?
Flesh.
The classic example is, you know, something about breast cancer could potentially be siphoned out if you've got some kind of automated system because it's got the word breast in it, and this country has a fixation
with breasts. It's a great question,
breasts.
Alex. So this product is not an age-appropriate product. That's one we'll bring out in the future, which will help you to determine whether it's appropriate in accordance to gambling and violence and nudity, for example. This is a very binary black and white decision. This really is adult content. And how our technology deciphers between the two is the string search. So we wouldn't just label a website that had the word sex, for example. It would have to be in the same sentence that contains other words. So there's a big difference between the content on a website that talks about pornography and a website that contains pornography. And I guess the one thing to stress about all of this is that we're not doing anything fantastically new in concept, but the technology is quite new. So ICRED, the Internet Content Rating Association, has been around since 1994, and they introduced a system called PIX, which is still in use by IE9 today in Content Advisor. But unfortunately, it never got any traction. We never got adoption for a number of reasons. One, it left up the responsibility to the website owners to self-label their website. For me, self-regulation by itself doesn't work, and enforcing certification doesn't work. I think when you offer the combination of those choices, it can work. Secondly, PIX only allowed you to make a claim about an entire website, so it wasn't possible to make a claim about an individual web page or exclude web pages. And then thirdly, ICRA didn't productize it for each country. They were really generic in what they allowed website owners to do, because what's appropriate for an 18-year-old in Germany is different in the UK. So our method of classification that we created to get it scalable, we put it through the W3C, and now it's a ratified standard and replaced PIX.
So do you think that the sites are going to have a sort of struggle with each other, trying to get, we want to get more icons, we want to be classified as having everything. Mm-hmm. All human life is there, and then a bit more.
Yeah, I think if every website owner wanted to do that would be great, because it would mean that we will turn a company into a $1 billion business sooner than I expected. I think the assertions...
Do you charge per icon then? How do you do it?
We've launched with the Family Safety product, just simply to get adoption, because we will have the biggest database of its kind worldwide in about 3 months. And is therefore more likely to be adopted by the mainstream browsers. And we're in discussion with some of the mainstream browsers. We're not interested in having add-ons like McAfee Site Advisor and AVG, Link Scanner. What we want to do is to build the add-ons to get the word out on the street and then get the mainstream browsers to implement better parental controls. So to answer your question, Charles, the type of assertions that we help website owners, or that we will build products for over in the coming months, are a seal for privacy, a seal for identity, so that website owners can demonstrate their commitment and conformance to a code of conduct for privacy. So consumers will have greater confidence in going to that website because they know that they follow 3 best practices with their personal information. Identity, which means that this website really belongs to this company or this person. So when you land on the webpage, you get something like a green URL bar, for example. And there are a number of other products. One in particular, which might be of interest to you actually, is wouldn't it be cool if in Google search results you could see which websites offer free content, products and services?
Well, that kind of leads on to what I was going to ask, which is from the point of view of a mainstream web consumer, what's this going to look like? How's it going to change their web experience? So when they go to a search engine and they do a search and it might, for whatever reason, inadvertently pick up inappropriate content, how's that going to look to them? And if they did go to that site, how are they going to, you know, what's that experience going to be like?
Well, right now with the Firefox add-on, when you do a search on Google and there are no adult content, adult websites in the search results, you don't see anything different. It's exactly the same. If, however, there's a site in the list that's being labeled by us, you get a little tiny icon, and it's an orange icon with three X's on it that symbolizes adult content. That's likely to change to something to be more positive reinforcement, like a family type icon.
And also perhaps not something so Netherlandish.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Dutch. Thank you very much. That's the word I was looking for.
And then when you hover over the little icon, you get a little pop-up that says, this website may contain adult content. So you know that it may contain adult content. And then when you click on the icon in the toolbar, the MetaCert icon, and you go into the settings, you can enable the password, which then means if you click on the link, you get a message that says this website has been restricted. And you may want that for two reasons. One, you don't want your children to access those websites. And two, if you're in work and you click on a link in an email, it launches your browser. Before it hits the web page, it comes up with the message saying this website is restricted because it may contain adult content.
It's going to become a badge of honor for websites.
Yeah, what is the appeals process, say, if a website doesn't in fact sort of fall within your...
Great question. So we also have a website dedicated to where the web community, we launched it yesterday, the web community can submit websites that they deem adult orientated. And that goes into a queue and people review those to make sure they're adult related and then label them. And then those people can become moderators and they can self-label.
How many sites are there out there?
Well, I believe there is something in the region.
The triple X.
Oh, triple X. There are they go on sale at the end of the year. The sunrise period happens very, very soon. There are over 650,000 unique pre-ordered domains currently. So it's a significant number, but that's even a small number by comparison to the number of .com and .org websites we intend to label. I mean, our spider is constantly labeling. But Alex, to go back to your question, we will also have a webpage dedicated to where site owners can dispute a site that's been labeled incorrectly, and then we can review that and act accordingly.
Do you think, just with the triple X thing, do you not think there's a possibility that people will just think, boy, here be dragons? You know, that they'll think it's just going to be such a den of weirdness that you've got to really take your life in your hands going there, or your PC in your hands.
Well, actually, if we look at it from an adult perspective, the triple X has a code of conduct. And the code of conduct includes we enforce the labeling of every website. So this is not an opt-in service. This is automated and it's compulsory. Secondly, the identity of every website owner has been verified by an independent third party. And thirdly, McAfee will scan every website automatically to make sure that they're malware-free. So there's that code of conduct. So if you're inclined to visit those types of websites, the chances are you may want to visit a .XXX website before any other website because you know that you're less likely to have malware downloaded to your computer, and you know that they're actually having their website labeled so that people can be, can exclude that kind of content because they don't think it's appropriate for them.
What are those guidelines? What does fall within the appropriate and inappropriate?
Well, actually, we don't decide what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. What we've done is we've created a very specific description to describe sexually explicit content. And it's very binary. When you go to an explicitly sexual content, you know it's not likely. You don't want your children visiting that website.
Dare I ask what it is?
I would need to read it out, but it would contain nudity in a way that's meant to arouse the person viewing it. So the description is very specific in that there's a difference between nudity in an educational way. So you might have some nude pictures on The Guardian. They're not going to be labelled as sexually explicit content because The Guardian would never host such content.
Yeah, it's going to be art if it's on our side.
Or art.
Suddenly, I just went somewhere down, sort of Peter Stringfellow.
You're thinking about a picture of the Chippendales. And I was
heading down. Honestly, yeah. I was heading down Peter Stringfellow. Who was it who said that table dancing bars are not inappropriate because sexual arousal is only a byproduct. It's not the intention of the site. I mean, I can see the semantic web is problematic because it doesn't actually deal with human semantics. It deals with computer semantics and demands that the builders of a website actually put this metadata on steroids into the content. And so to create a binary one or zero for the spider and for the system is you're going to get a lot of false hits, aren't you?
I don't think so, because what you and I and Charles and Jemima would deem as sexually explicit content, I can almost guarantee you we would all agree. And then if I showed you something that was that contained some sexual content that wasn't explicit and wasn't intended to arouse the viewer, I'm pretty sure we would all agree on what that is as well. So we don't, again, we don't tell people what's appropriate or inappropriate. This is basically pornography. But if you look at the definition of pornography or sexually explicit content, it's very vague, even on Wikipedia. So what we did is we had a look on Wikipedia. Yes.
Line of the
week. Even on Wikipedia. So we looked at sites like YouTube and so on that looked at that kind of content.
Well, you can find out even more. And wow, do I have a lot of questions that I'd still like to ask at metacert.com. That's all for this week's podcast. Thanks very much to Paul Walsh, Jemima Kish, and Charles Arthur. Next week, Nick Brisbourne is coming in, a VC. Jemima, you know Nick. What do you expect him to speak about?
He's great. He's got loads of insights. He's been around for years. He's got some great contacts, and he's supporting some really good companies. So he's going to have a great perspective on what's going on at the moment and how bubbly things are.
And also in the next few weeks, we'll be hearing from Ian Bickerstaff of Sony to find out what plans they have for 3D on the PlayStation, and Patrick Spence from RIM about BlackBerry's current fortunes. Now, just before we go, a reminder that we are after volunteers to answer a couple of audience research questions about how we can make even better podcasts for you in the future. If you're interested in taking part, then do drop us an email at techweekly@guardian.co.uk. And we will send you details nearer the time. Also, if you're interested in sponsoring us, please also send us an email to techweekly@guardian.co.uk. See all the links from this program at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. The producer was Scott Colley. I'm Alex Kratosky, and we are back next Tuesday. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.
Tech Weekly is sponsored by crunch.co.uk. Stuck in the accountancy stone age? Crunch's cloud software and team of accredited accountants will take care of all your paperwork, expenses, tax liabilities, and more for a flat monthly fee of £59.50 plus VAT. Visit crunch.co.uk for a free trial.